1954, a far cry from what they experienced in Reconstruction.
So one of the places where the analogy really falls down is in economics.
Yeah, that's one.
Do you think, what do you think would happen if the Voting Rights Act is not renewed and Congress ends up passing this anti-busing amendment that they passed, that the House has passed? Because it may get over to a judicial area.
Well, it's a funny thing about the voting rights thing. In some parts of Mississippi, the black people have been voting all the time. For example, in Adams County, Natchez, and on the Mississippi coast and other places, but they had not been in the state as a whole, of course. I don't know. I here in this county, we've never had a voting referee. We've never had the schools were integrated on a consent decree. You find different conditions in different parts of Mississippi. Mississippi is really about three states, just about like Tennessee. Geographically, you've got the Delta, you've got the Northeast Hills, of which this is a part. You've got South Mississippi and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. South Mississippi was largely uninhabited before the Civil War, and now has a majority of the population in the state. I think if the voting rights bill were repealed tomorrow, that the right of the Negro people to vote would not be tampered with anymore. For one thing, all of the things that the people were afraid of would happen, to wit, more especially block voting, just has not happened. We've seen. Let's take Charles Evers, for example. Obviously, they lacked about 100,000 folks getting the black voting strength for governor in the 1971 general election. Time and time and time again, we see white people elected in counties where the overwhelming majority of the voting population is black. Then, too, the black people are educated now so much more so than they used to be, and they're in far better position to intelligently vote instead of being marched in and voted as a group. And that did go on after the Civil War. That's altogether in reality what caused their disenfranchisement in the Constitution of 1890. My family have always enjoyed very close individual relationships with black people. And of course, they say that about the South. They say that as individuals, we're great friends, as groups, we're great enemies, and all that sort of thing. But my grandfather told me about how he could take a box of cigars and go to a voting precinct in the 1870s and 1880s. Vote every colored man who showed up to vote. And he said it was a reprehensible practice, but it had to be done because that was the only way that they could in any way influence the outcome of an election. But bear in mind, those people had grown up, and when it was against the law to even teach them how to read and write. And it was against the law to teach them how to read and write because they didn't want them to be able to forge passes by which they could go from place to place and make their escape. It was a cruelty, born of a cruelty. But I just look at it here today. Somebody sent me an old roster of the Mississippi Legislature in 1884, and they had 14 black men in the Mississippi House of Representatives in 1884. And we've got one today after the Voting Rights Act been in effect 10 years. So what I'm saying is that, and then I think that just the general conscience of the people is much more satisfied with saying, well, let him go on and vote, and then whatever happens, why, it can't be said that it's brought about by intimidation or racial exclusion or anything like that. Of course, the Voting Rights Act's been reenacted. How much longer? 5 more years?
Runs out next year.
And they say, I don't know why they didn't just make it permanent, you know. They've certainly got that authority under the 15th Amendment, but I guess they had some reason for not to. Maybe they couldn't pass it as a permanent thing, and maybe they thought it wouldn't be necessary as a permanent thing. But funny thing about that, you know, in 1939, and I wasn't 25 years old, and I don't know what possessed the people to do it, but I didn't know any better then. I was elected district attorney of this district, 7 counties. And I never shall forget going up that walk out there to the courthouse to vote that morning, and I met up with Meek Chillers, who was a colored man, and he said, but my good friend, he said, Mr. Coleman, you know I can't vote for you. I said, I know that, Meek, I'm sorry. Well, he said, I prayed for you all night last night. Well, I said, your prayers are probably worth a heck of a lot more than mine, and I appreciate it. The cold truth of business is, it just isn't that much individual animosity between white and black people when it comes to selecting somebody to hold an office. Now, maybe there are places, they're bound to be, there are exceptions to all rules. There are places where they'll just vote for a black man because he's black. But right here in this congressional district, 4 years ago, I guess it was, a black candidate ran against Tom Abernathy for Congress. And over here in South Ackerman, where this county is about 71% white and 29% black, and nearly all the black people in the county live over here in the South Ackerman precinct, and they all voted away at the courthouse. And that fellow didn't get but 5 or 6 votes for Congress. Well, obviously, they were going to vote for a black man because he's a black man. They darn well knew who he was, all right. They'd been well publicized. Then, amazingly enough, the overwhelming majority of them voted for Nixon for president, and the election returns will bear it out. So I don't think if the Voting Rights Act were left to die or repeal tomorrow, it would make any difference in Mississippi now. Of course, I argued when I was governor that we had an untenable position. I told the legislature, I said, when you let a white man go in and vote, whether he can read or write or not, the law said he couldn't, but still they let him vote anyhow. And you won't let a high school graduate or college graduate vote because he's black. You know you're going to lose. And the result of it is going to be that they're going to require you to let the fellow who has no education at all and no real ability to cast an intelligent vote, he's going to vote too. And it's just a matter of time if it's going to happen. If you don't clean up your own house, the time will come when Congress will do it for you, because there may be some doubt about the authority on local schools, but there isn't any doubt about the franchise. Well, they still didn't do anything about it, so. Although there were plenty of members of the legislature who thought it ought to be done. So, I don't think that the repeal of the Voting Rights Act will make any difference. And, of course, as far as the schools were concerned, here we were running 2 sets of schools for 1 set of children. I'm pretty well satisfied. Of course, it's not going to be changed. But there wouldn't be anything like the Great Revolution if it were repealed, a lot of people think. As far as busing is concerned, well, we've always bused in this county, you see, so it doesn't make any difference in the rural areas. I went to high school myself from the farm out here to Ackerman on a school bus over 40 years ago. Where the problem comes in places like Jackson, where they'll pick up a child and drive him past 3 or 4 schoolhouses to one just to attain a racial balance. And I think the opposition to that is still mighty strong, even amongst the black people themselves in some instances. But you don't have a few places in Mississippi where that's a problem. Jackson, Greenwood, some locations like that. And of course in counties like Kemper down here, where the blacks outnumber the whites, 85 to 15, those private schools are going to continue because of problems that I can't help and you can't help. Nobody else is going to help for the next 25 years. It's going to be a process of education.
You, I believe, were on the bench once and then ran for elective office subsequently.
Well, I was a state circuit judge, but that's elective too.
Oh, that's elective also?
I was elected circuit judge in 1946.
Any chance you may return to elective politics?
Well, I guess I'm locked in now. I've spent 9 years on this job and I don't have six more to go to earn my retirement. And there's not much sense. And had a letter from a lady today wanting to know if I would please run for governor again. And I wrote her back and told her that if I consulted my heart, I most certainly would. But upon consulting my head, I could not. So I guess that's the answer to it. Might not get elected anyway. I might wind up like Richardson Pryor in North Carolina, who quit the federal bench to run for governor and led the ticket 100,000 votes and got beaten off, you know, back a few years ago. He's in Congress now, I think. Of course, I like Mississippi, obviously. I wouldn't stay here. I could live anywhere in these six states if I had a preference, but I don't have any. They say that's a great weakness of Southerners, attachment for place. But when I got out of the governor's office and came back to Ackerman and started practicing law, which I did for 5 years before I was appointed to the court, somebody said, "What do you want to go back to that little old town for?" I said, "I guess it's because that's the only place where I feel reasonably certain that I know where I am and what I'm doing." So that's it. I'd like to be governor again. I think that great things could be done for Mississippi with the right kind of aggressive and firm leadership. But one man can't do everything. And there are a lot of things I couldn't do. I tried my best as governor of Mississippi to get a constitutional convention to rewrite the legislative apportionment, which couldn't possibly stand on any line of reasoning, and to rewrite the franchise provisions of the Constitution and do a lot of other things. I hadn't run on that platform. It was just something that after I got my platform into law, I decided to take one step further. And we passed in the Senate and got beat in the House by 7 votes. That was it. Since then, the federal courts have just about rewritten the entire document, and I've twice had to sit on a 3-judge court which reapportioned the legislature, the very thing I tried to get them to do this as. So I expect that's the history of mankind. No, it doesn't really discourage me a lot, but it's wholly unnecessary. They can do it themselves, but they're not. They won't. Getting two houses to agree on who's going to walk the plank and who's not, you know, is just asking too much. And yet, you know, Mississippi, up to the Constitution of 1890, reapportioned itself every 10 years just as conscientiously and regularly as the time rolled around. But they wrote the reapportionment into the Constitution in 1890. It had been in the statutes up to then. And then it took a 2/3 vote of both houses on 3 different legislative days, submitted to the people in an election in which a majority of all those participating in the election had to vote for it, to amend it. I did get that changed. I did get the Constitution amended to where 2/3 on any one day could propose an amendment. And where a majority of those voting on the amendment would approve it, we slacked it up to that extent. And I did take the lead in cutting the size of the House down from 149, I believe it was, to 120. The others were just more or less trading bait. They were just there, and they just fought along when Mr. So-and-so crooked his finger, and that wasn't representation. The thing that disappointed me about the Constitutional Convention was the fact that Mr. Walter Sillars, Speaker of the House, who had been such a strong champion of it when it failed in 1934, was opposed through at this time. If I'd had his help, we would have put it over.
How would you characterize the role and power of Walter Sellers when he was speaking?
Well, he was a very, very powerful man. Legislatively, there were people who said he was more powerful than the governor. Of course, that wasn't true. He certainly exercised more power than the governor on the legislative processes because he appointed the committees. That's still the system down there. They don't do like they do in Congress and have a committee on committees and so on. But I tell you, see, he may have been ever to be Speaker of the House before he ultimately got there. He supposedly represented the Bourbons. Not only supposedly, but did. He was one man who would have made a great governor of Mississippi by ability and by personal strength and so forth, but he was never willing to pay the price. He didn't want to get out and get with and among the people, something that I dearly like to do. I have often said that no man could make a race for governor or even serve as governor unless he liked it. It's such a painful thing. Mr. Sellers wouldn't do that. Finally, he got elected Speaker of the House in 1944, and he stayed there until his death in 1965. And it was easy for him to do. We have a first primary and a second primary. All right, about maybe 51% of the House will be elected in the first. Okay, Mr. Sellers gets busy, and he commits all them, you see, before the second primary comes off. Well, the governor's busy getting himself elected governor in that runoff. That's when all the blood flows is in the second. So, he's already in before the governor gets in. Now, that does not keep the governor from, if he wants to, giving him a terrible time and fighting him to the last ditch. But all that gets the governor is the appointment of hostile committees who will kill everything he wants, or most of it. Bilbo had that, you know, in 1928. In 1928, the Big Four, composed of Sellers, Kennedy, George, and Tom Bailey, totally wrecked his administration. Well, in 1956, a bunch of young men wanted William Winter to run for Speaker against Mr. Sellers. William Winter was my very devoted friend, and I was his. In fact, I later appointed him state tax collector, which was on a fee basis and the most lucrative job in the state. I appointed him because he deserved it. His father was a state senator when I was just a young beginner and a great man. Before William got going, old Mr. Sellers already had the votes. Well, yet Mr. Sellers was a pretty good operator. I know darn well, I don't know it either. He might have voted for me for governor. I don't really know. Although I was from the hills and he was from the Delta and I was a Democrat. And he was one of those who walked out in 48. As a matter of fact, I'm a yellow dog Democrat. Never have made any bones about it. You know what a yellow dog Democrat is, don't you?
I think I do, but I'd like to hear your definition.
A yellow dog Democrat is a man who will vote for a yellow dog if he's running on a Democrat ticket. Well, I'm not quite that bad, but anyway, when that election's over, he came over here and he said, "Came, I started off practicing law in that little office right over there. I built it. And his own railroad property, and I built it that framed where I could move if I had to, but my son's now the district attorney in this district, and he has his office over there and has my old library and so forth. But incidentally, he was elected on a Democrat ticket, too. But he came over here and he said, "Now, I got the votes," he says, "I think, to be elected. But I don't want to have any fight about it if I can help it. And I'll promise you this, that if you will not interfere in my election, I will actively support your program. Not to stifle your opposition to me, but because I think it is a good program anyway. And he said, I've had to deal with governors who had no program. But I had one to tell me when I went to see him. He said, I don't have any. Well, I said, Mr. Seller, that's fair enough. I said, you know my friendship for William Winter, and that's not going to be diminished, but I'm realist enough to know that you already have it. Well, William stayed on in the race against my advice and, of course, was clobbered, and when I keenly regretted that. But Mr. Sellers kept his word. We passed. Did you know that when I was elected governor of Mississippi, that the state of Mississippi didn't even regulate the electric power companies and the natural gas companies? They'd always been able to keep it off. That was one of the planks of my platform. Well, Mr. Sellers was a lifelong lawyer for the power companies. Everybody knew that. But he supported the bill because of that pledge. He was a very, very honorable man, my only, and a very able man. My only regret is that he didn't always see eye to eye with me on supporting the Democratic Party or on various other governmental questions. Sellers never would. I tried to get party registration. They said, but we still don't have it. Republican go right down there, vote in the Democratic primary. That happened to me in 63. I don't think it defeated me. I don't think it's enough to defeat me. But many of the Republicans openly stated that they were going to support Johnson and Runoff because they could beat him more easily in November than they could me. And in the so-called heavy Republican counties, don't have a handful of them, you can look and see what happened. But when I ran for governor in 1963, when I spoke in Cleveland in the county seat of Barber County, Mr. Siller was on the front row. And as despite our disagreement about the Constitutional Convention, he wouldn't have been there if he had been very much opposed to me, because his presence was an implied support, if nothing else. So I guess you'd say that all big men, and he was a big man, have their various facets. And they're not always just one. I don't like to use the word color. Use some other synonymous term. They change according to various facts and circumstances. Mr. Sellers mellowed a whole lot as he got older. I served one term in the legislature after I was governor. No man in Mississippi has ever been elected to a place in the executive, legislative, and judicial, all three. And the representative from this county was quitting anyway, so I ran, was elected, and served under Mr. Sellers in the House. And had a real interesting development on that. The governor in Mississippi serves 2 weeks beyond the incoming legislature, so I was governor for 2 weeks with the legislature that I was elected to serve in. Well, of course, I served out my time as governor, but some of those old boys that had fought me so hard when I was governor and who had formerly been in the Sellers phalanx, so to speak, they put out the word if I didn't resign the governor's office and come around and be sworn in the same day they were, that they were going to declined to admit me when I came around to be sworn in under that old clause, you know, at each house is a judge of the election and qualification of its members. In other words, they were going to declare the office vacant. So I heard about it. Mr. Sellers in the Capitol one day, and I told him about it. He said, well, I'll guarantee you one thing, or anything like that take place. So I just went home and didn't say anything. I served my time out. 2 or 3 days later, I reported to the House of Representatives to take the oath, and not one of them said a word. I think he had already put out the word. So he was a very powerful man. He was not And what I'm saying to you, I'm not agreeing with a lot of the things he stood for in the legislature. He was one of those that was strongly opposed to any change in the franchise provisions, for example. But, not a bad man at all.
Anything else you wanted to add to help us in our understanding?
Well, I go back to...
Let me ask you this one question.
Yes, sir.
With this tradition of populism that you mentioned, particularly in this part of Mississippi, do you think that with the racial issue submerged and as a political issue, at least at this time, that the populist issues will reemerge as viable political issues?
Well, my best guess is not, because race was not involved in the populist movement, you know, start with. That was purely economic, the farmer against business. And, you know, back in those 1890s, of course, we had the panic of 1893, but more than that, cotton was 5 cents a pound, and this was a one-crop economy, and the farmers were in deplorable condition. And really, what they were trying to do, as I analyzed, was start to get up a kind of a farmers' union. They couldn't do it because there were too many farmers. Now, if there's any independent soul on earth, it is a farmer, and they just couldn't make it. I think that 1974, we lack only a few days now, being up to May 17. I think 1974 in Mississippi is politically and governmentally and economically an altogether different time, the way it was then. Now, I don't mean that, you know, the Supreme Court speaks of all the vestiges must be eliminated, root and branch. No, that hadn't happened. I think anybody would be highly unrealistic to suppose that it had. But I go back, it's altogether different. Nobody's run for governor of Mississippi on a racial approach since 1963. That's been 11 years ago.
You would even include John Bell Williams in that?
He didn't. His campaign in that respect was really very muted compared to what we've been accustomed to see in Mississippi, as I recall it. Now, of course, I was circuit judge then, but I wasn't paying the acute attention to it. I did in former years, but I don't recall any blatant racism in that grade, in that campaign. Say the least of the matter, he's the fellow that polished off Ross Barnett. And if you want to look at a revolutionary change, let's take Barnett. The quotes hero unquotes of Oxford in 62. Got 10% of the votes in 67, just 5 years later.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I want to add a little more frosting to the cake, then I'll come back. And if I forget to, I remind you. Paul Johnson was elected governor in 63 on Oxford and on my relationship with the Kennedys. He ran for lieutenant governor in 67 and didn't even get in the second primary. Now, that's 67 for you. John Bell Williams, of course, and I were never political friends. He was in the East, Brady, what have you, axis. As I've already said, was in the White, Stennis, what have you, axis. However, you know, they contested their seats in the House of Representatives in 1965 after the 1964 election, and they were going to throw them out. And to my surprise, they employed me as their counsel in that contest, and so I was hung up with old Brother Consular in that crowd for about 6 months. during which time John Bell and I got to be good friends personally. I had never known anything about him, and he and Brady and Easley, you know, came out right after I'd been elected governor in 55 and announced with great headlines that the legislature, as soon as it met, should adopt a resolution of nullification. And of course, I, being younger then than I am now, and so forth, it made me mad that they had presumed to say what should be done when, before I could even get sworn in, or, and after all, they had not been elected governor, so we had a pretty severe exchange about that, but in the press and otherwise. But he made a far more reasonable, tolerant governor along that line than anybody would have thought he would, even 3 years before he was elected. And as I've already said, Bill Waller not only did not run on it, but more than that, so far as I can tell, has not pursued it as governor. So we'll get back. It's not the same state, either politically, or educationally, or economically. Now this looks like a rural county to you as you drive through it. And it is in geography. But we have far more people employed in these industries you see strung out around town today than we had than we have farming. And that did not come to pass until, well, we got our last, well, only this year we got a $3 million plant, Tennessee River Pulp and Paper, which is a subsidiary of Tenneco, one of these companies in the country. But even before it came, we were already predominantly industrial so far as employment was concerned. Well, there can be no discrimination in employment. These people are working side by side in one of these factories. I haven't heard of a single racial incident in one of them. I have not heard of a racial incident in the school. Maybe it's because in this area, everybody knows everybody else is an individual. It's not a question of white against black. It's Joe against Jim, if you want to put it that way. But it's largely true of the whole state. We still believe, of course, we still got a lot of strong beliefs in Mississippi to the effect that government ought to be responsible. It ought to be financially responsible. And it ought not to operate on a deficit basis. Mississippi state government has not had a deficit since 1932, which is 32 years, and they only had that one because of the Depression. We still think that people ought to work for a living, and they ought not to be supported by the labor of others if they themselves are able to work. By the same token, we think that it's the duty of those who are able to take care of those who, through no fault of their own, economically or otherwise, are not able. I just wonder what Senator Bill Bowe and those other great antagonists, Jim Vardaman, would think if they were to come back to Mississippi today. And more especially if they got on the stump and said the things that they said and believed in, they wouldn't get anywhere.
What do you think Senator Bill Bowe would think if he came back today?
I don't know. I think he'd be in an altogether almost new world. Maybe not entirely new. He'd still see black people and white people, but it'd be mostly new. People can change. I don't believe you'd find a man in Mississippi today who would say that slavery is morally right. And everybody knows today that it was economically the worst thing you could possibly have. It had the South almost broke before the Civil War, as far as its debts to New York and so forth are concerned. You can't feed a man and clothe him and house him and till he's big enough to work, and then take care of him in his illnesses and take care of him in his old age and use his involuntary labor and make anything out of it. Yet, 100 years ago, almost a little over 100, 110 years ago, people were taught from the pulpit that it was morally right and that it was an economic necessity. Well, they don't believe that anymore. They haven't for a long time.
Getting back to that quote Ross Barnett received in 67, what do you think that meant?
Well, I think it just meant that the people of Mississippi, number one, had found out that he had not represented their best interest in the Oxford episode. And I think it meant they didn't want to risk him with any more, with the governor's office anymore. I can't see how you can interpret it any other way. There's just not any other way to it. If they had been satisfied with what he'd done at Oxford, if they'd been satisfied with his other performance as governor, I don't know of any reason why they shouldn't have voted to re-elect him, but the fact remains they didn't. I believe he carried one county out of 82, which was Leake County, where he was born and raised. So, we had in the gubernatorial campaign of 1971, we had a circuit judge right here in this district named Marshall Perry. He was born and raised in this county, but he moved to Grenada to practice law when he got out of Ole Miss. He and I finished high school together. And he ran on that old fire-eating platform. And he didn't care any county. Not the first one. So now, you can learn a lot from looking at the election returns. Of course, I think that if a man got out here and ran for office on the platform that I am black and I am entitled to the office, and I'm going to see that the bottom rail gets on top and all that old inflammatory stuff, he'd get beat just like a white supremacist is going to say, well, I'm going to return them to separate schools, or I'm going to reinstate slavery, so to speak. I think those are dark rivers that we've crossed. I really believe it. I just don't see how they could possibly be any return. I wonder if you've seen anybody in Mississippi who thinks he could. Just asking you to put a bomb, to tie a bomb onto my automobile, and got intercepted out here at the corporate limits, although his interceptor didn't know what he was up to. I later found out all about it from the FBI, who course had them infiltrated, but I often wondered what he came up here for. I was not in any office, wasn't holding any office, wasn't running for any office. They're funny people, but you can find them interest in Mississippi, but it's real interesting that he thought that. Have you made any in-depth investigation as to what the membership of the Citizens Council is, or anything like that?
No.
It was inactive while I was governor. And, I signed the bill for two reasons. Number one, they were going to pass it over my veto if I didn't. And number two, I got up to concede that I could make to appoint the majority of the members, so appointing the majority of the members, like, it wasn't going to do all that much harm at the worst. And one of the great issues all during that 4 years was, you know, give them state money. And I never would agree to it. And of course, they should back me.